Your old or broken phone can let you down. But at Verizon, trade in any old phone from our top brands and get iPhone 16 Pro with Apple Intelligence with a new line on MyPlan and iPad and Apple Watch Series 10. After all, you don't want your old phone to die on you when you're lost.
Perfect.
Or for your broken phone to glitch at the worst possible time.
Hey, can I get your number?
Oh. Trade in your old phone for a brand new iPhone 16 Pro, iPad, and Apple Watch. Visit Verizon.com today. Additional terms apply. Service plan required for Apple Watch and iPad.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices. Plus, extra ways to save. Like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. And up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Yeah, sure thing.
Hey, you sold that car yet?
Yeah, sold it to Carvana.
Oh, I thought you were selling to that guy.
The guy who wanted to pay me in foreign currency, no interest over 36 months? Yeah, no. Carvana gave me an offer in minutes, picked it up, and paid me on the spot. It was so convenient.
Just like that?
Yep.
No hassle?
None.
That is super convenient.
Sell your car to Carvana and swap hassle for convenience. Pickup fees may apply.
Your old or broken phone can let you down. But at Verizon, trade in any old phone from our top brands and get iPhone 16 Pro with Apple Intelligence with a new line on MyPlan and iPad and Apple Watch Series 10. After all, you don't want your old phone to die on you when you're lost.
Perfect.
Or for your broken phone to glitch at the worst possible time.
Hey, can I get your number?
Oh.
Trade in your old phone for a brand new iPhone 16 Pro, iPad, and Apple Watch. Visit Verizon.com today. Additional terms apply. Service plan required for Apple Watch and iPad.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Daily. Today is Friday, February 21st, 2025. On today's episode of the show, we're going to be talking about Oz Perkins' newest movie, The Monkey, and we'll present an interview with Oz Perkins. My name is Ben Pearson. I am an editor at SlashFilm.com, and I'm joined on today's episode by Slash Film staff writers Bill Bria.
Hello, hello.
And Jeremy Mathai.
Hey, folks. Happy to be here.
All right. So, guys, let's talk about The Monkey. We're going to do some spoiler-free, just broad thoughts to kick things off, and then we'll get into spoilers. I'll clearly mark that part of the conversation so folks can pause and go check out the movie and then come back and listen to that discussion. But I think from talking with you both on Slack, Bill, you like this movie. Jeremy, not as much. And I find myself right in the middle, kind of like I like certain aspects of it. Other things of it, not really crazy about. So let's start with the positives. Bill, what did you connect with in The Monkey? What did you like about the movie?
I am always down for a wild swing, especially by some filmmakers that I really love or have come to love, and Oz Perkins is absolutely one of those. I will say that off the bat, this is not my favorite of his, because I am very much on board for his somnambulance, dread-filled, very insidious feeling, satanic movies that he's made up until this point, which is why Long Legs I was so gaga for, and I went crazy for that one last year. And this one, of course, is a very big pivot from him. It's incredibly, obviously, a comedy, where I know there's other folks that have seen comedy in other parts of his films before now, but I think that this one is obviously very much intentionally a comedy. It is James Wong and Glenn Morgan Final Destination ilk in terms of its mean-spiritedness and its kills and its very black comedic look at the way that people in life, but also just in films, in characters in the movie, can just die suddenly and that's the end, and not having any sort of cushion to deal with that. I do find it to be overall a very fun, very bitter, very scampy kind of horror comedy that feels to me like not only Final Destination lies, as I mentioned earlier, but also it does seem to bring a little bit of the Stephen King quality of when King starts to get a little goofy or a little mean-spirited. I'm thinking of stuff like Creepshow. I'm thinking of Maximum Overdrive. I'm thinking of the X-Files episodes that Stephen King wrote. I know these aren't typically King fans King stuff. You know, it's not what he's known for the most. It's not what he's best at, even really. But he does have that weird sort of mean streak in him, where his sense of humor can be very odd and very off-putting and very just brazen. And this feels like it's tapped into that side of King, which is something we don't see as much. You know, I think we're used to sort of the Mike Flanagan, you know, very like rich, you know, weighty, you know, thematic and dramatic stuff and creepy and, you know, all that sort of thing, which is fantastic. But yeah, this feels like it's exploiting that a little bit. And yeah, I think it just had a good overall time. I think it's a nice change of pace, and it's something that eerily enough feels more resonant in the way that it's being released now than when I saw it a few months ago before the end of the year.
Interesting. Okay, so maybe I'll remind me to come back to that.
Before
I forget, I wanted to mention that you talk directly with Perkins about the Stephen King references and things like that, so people can hear that in the interview that'll be coming up in a little bit. I was reminded a lot of Stand By Me, obviously, the voiceover in this movie from Theo James, who has a great voiceover voice,
great
by the
voice.
Way. Like that, yeah, deep, really resonant voice. It was really excellent. I almost thought it was like a different person doing the narration for a little while, and then I was like, oh man, that's him. He's doing a great job here. So yeah, definitely some Stand By Me vibes in the just the intonations and the way that narration is used in this movie. Jeremy, on your end of things, what didn't work for you? What did you not connect to about the monkey?
Yeah, I'm prepared to be the wet blanket after following that eloquent defense by Bill right there. But I mean, and I'll start by saying I loved everything that Bill just described about the movie. I just wish that was the movie that I personally saw. You know, it was just, I loved Longlegs. I share that in common with a lot of people, I'm sure. It's just, you know, going that hard for such a supernatural serial killer movie that it just, like, you know, with literally Satan himself, like, it's going that hard. And I appreciated the switch from going to that to something as over the top schlocky as The Monkey. You know, I was a big fan of Neon's marketing push for this movie. I thought it was pitch perfect, and I loved the movie that they were selling. And then, you know, I think when I finally got to see the movie for myself, all the pieces were in place for this campy B-movie horror flick that I really, really was in the bag for. But there's just something about, I don't know, the world building for this movie, the tone that Perkins was going for. It just left me cold and kind of feeling distant from all the action that was happening on the screen. The kills are as gruesome and, I mean, almost Rube Goldbergian as you could hope. Theo James, as you mentioned, like, his narration is great, and he's having the time of his life in these two roles as twin brothers. And I actually think Perkins does a really, really good job selling us on, you know, the admittedly silly idea of a stationary wind-up toy monkey that's actually kind of a terrifying, unpredictable villain in this. But I kind of mentioned this in my review for Slash Film, but it's just the script at times feels like it's just kind of throwing everything at the wall in the hopes of seeing what sticks. I mean, and that kind of applies to, like, the gags. You know, the movie is pretty funny, but I felt like for every gag that worked, there was another two that just landed so flat for me. There's this recurring gag with the movie keeps on smash cutting to, after a pretty brutal kill in the early going, it'll smash cut to this just the most overmatched, inept funeral sermon from a priest that you can imagine. And he's just, it is the worst thing that you could possibly imagine sitting through in the wake of, like, someone's death that's actually close to you. And it's that left me and the press screening that I was at, we were dying at that every single time. But beyond that, I don't know, something, there's just something off. The jokes weren't landing. Some of the kills kind of teetered on the edge of being a little too mean-spirited for my liking, at least. And I think the tone kind of got away from Perkins a bit in a way that it never did with Longlegs.
Okay, so I'm going to go ahead and put a spoiler marker here. So I'm shoving this flag in the ground. We're going to be talking spoilers now, so press pause. This is your last chance. But I did want to ask both of you about the kills specifically and, like, whether or not that worked for you. Obviously, Bill, you mentioned the Final Destination franchise, and this movie, I think, is very much in that lineage and kind of nodding and winking to that level of out of nowhere ridiculous violence. So Jeremy, I guess we'll just stick with you. Like, you kind of hinted there in your description that, like, some of that stuff didn't work for you as well as the others. Are there moments that stood out to you that you remember that either didn't really feel like they fit with the rest of the movie, or just, like, stood out to you as being, like, too much, or what was your thought there?
Yeah, there's, I can pinpoint one late kill in the movie. There's this, in the plot, there's this kind of like a local burnout named Ricky, that he's kind of like hanging out kind of on the edges of the plot for most of the movie until he finally takes matters into his own hands and ends up kidnapping our main character and his son. And while they're right outside where the evil twin, I think his name's, his name might be Bill. I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, his name is Bill, and then the other one is Hal.
Right. So where his hideout is, that there he's waiting outside of, in a car, and you know the movie kind of like plays a little tongue in cheek. They notice that there's a like a wasp hive, just hanging out right by the building, and like it keeps on cutting to it a little ominously. You know, any horror fan can put the pieces together. They know exactly where this is going. And once you know things fall into place, and the hive of bees end up going straight into the car, into the open mouth of poor little Ricky, and just you know, it is a nasty kill. It lives up to the hype in that regard. But I also feel like there's just something about how that plays out that left me feeling a little like, I don't know, this went a little too far in one extreme, in a way again that I never really got from Longlegs. So I, for one, appreciated him taking this big tonal swing in the opposite direction, but it just didn't land for me. I don't know. That feeling stuck with me throughout this entire movie.
Yeah, I had trouble with that kill as well for the same reason. Like, there's something about the, maybe realism is the wrong word, but like, I guess kind of sort of believability yeah. of some of the, you know, when like one of the characters, like I think it's Bill and Hal's aunt, steps through a broken stair and falls into a vat of fishing hooks basically and gets all these stuck in her face. And it's like, that is kind of a plausible thing that like could happen. This wasp thing, this bee thing or whatever, there's no way that that would happen. And so the movie is like leveling up into a heightened state that I'm not sure that it earned at that point. But Bill, what did you think about that kill and then like the kills overall?
Well, that kill, my rebuttal essentially is in large part because of my relationship to the Final Destination franchise, which I recently revisited last year in prep for that one. Has a new one coming out this year called Bloodlines, I believe. And I am a big fan of the first two Final Destination films. I really love what they were cooking with this idea of death has a plan, and if you screw up that plan, it's going to come back to get you in some way. And, you know, very Rube Goldbergian way sort of idea. And it's something that they were going really galaxy brain with in Final Destination 2 of like, you know, now these victims are the people who maybe should have died if the people who in the original movie died when they were supposed to and they didn't. You know, it was going into this very like crazy idea that they couldn't really sustain for more than two movies. So with the third film, which a lot of people either love or in my case, I don't love it so much, they go back to this idea of, okay, well, now there's going to be another accident and people are going to escape it. And then those people are going to be targeted by death and so on and so forth. But gone was this, you know, idea of, okay, there's a plan, there's some sort of, you know, pattern, blah, blah, blah. It just felt like it was essentially an excuse to do the meanest kills possible, which is what it does. And some of them are great. But I did feel like there was a weight that got removed in that film. So when I saw this, you know, I was able to clue into what I felt Perkins was doing in terms of, it's very on the nose. He literally has Tatiana Maslany's mother character, Lois, say it, you know, in one part. And I think it's on the poster of like, everybody dies and that's life and that's messed up. And you know, I think she uses a stronger word there, but, okay, so that's your thesis, right? And I was then able to jump on board with this idea of, oh, all of this mean-spiritedness and the craziness, the Rube Goldberginess of the kills is just this enhanced or heightened way of fitting this thesis of like, there's just awful, awful stuff that happens to people for no good reason, no better reason than it's just their, you know, bad luck or, you know, whatever luck that, you know, happens to people in real life. And in some cases, you know, it's never as obviously is usually never as elaborate or crazy or plausible or implausible as that, or as the, you know, bees flying into your mouth. But I did appreciate the, you know, metaphor of that in terms of like, you know, as soon as I understood that that's where we were going in terms of the tone for me was, oh, you know, awful, awful stuff happens in life. It is so absurd that you're either crying or, you know, trying to yell at the sky about it. Like, why? There must be a reason. There must be a pattern. or you just have to sit back and laugh your ass off in terms of like, okay, none of it makes sense anymore. I'm going mad. And really what I was hinting at in the pre-spoiler section of, you know, The Resonance is we've entered another period of American life that is hard. you know, I'm not going to get into the politics of it on this episode, but you can draw your own conclusions. But even the element in this movie of a very obvious sort of apocalyptic tone by the end of the film, certainly the last couple scenes. And when you have planes falling out of the sky, I was like, this feels weirdly relevant right now in a way that I don't love. But, you know, it's that sort of absurdism that I feel like I will look out my window and see. And it's that sort of thing of like, well, I never would have expected this to happen in a just or sane world, but it feels like we're living in an insane world anyway. So, yeah, there's a monkey out there.
Yeah, that's a totally valid read. And Chris Evangelista was on this podcast last week talking a little bit about he saw an early screening of the movie. He mentioned Oz Perkins' background and the terrible ways that both of his parents died in real life. And it definitely feels like Perkins is working through some stuff about death in this movie and about how he feels about that concept. And yeah, like you said, the kind of like, you know, the randomness of it all and the unfairness of it all and all of that. I think that stuff comes across pretty well. I think the fatherhood theme, like the absent father passing down trauma stuff, is maybe like a little much. Like you mentioned, Jeremy, that character Ricky, who is like this little underling who works for Bill, one of the twins. And the Ricky character just didn't really quite work for me because he's another character who has this absent father. And it feels like the movie's drawing this parallel between him and the twins as people who are suffering from the effects of having their fathers abandon them early in life. But we never really get a sense of Ricky's motivation or the character or like who he is or what he wants for that to really land in an effective way. So I just thought it was like a little narratively awkward. But I guess like on a thematic level, Jeremy, what did you think about this movie and what it was doing? And if you had any response to what Bill was saying earlier.
Yeah. And Bill's point about, you know, kind of this movie sort of being Osgood Perkins filmmaking via therapy sort of thing. I think that's very, very on point. He's definitely not subtle about it. It is very much a case of just how random and pointless a lot of life is. But my only reservation is movies that make that sort of not a cynical point. It's a very, you know, it's just realistic. It just it runs the risk of just kind of, you know, throwing up your hands and going, well, yeah, nothing matters. So like anything can happen. And that's just a storytelling beat that you need to really, really drill down in the script. And I kind of feel like this is maybe just a couple tweaks or two away from really underlining that point in a way that I could have got on board with. Or, you know, I realize I'm in the very, very minority of not liking this movie as much as others do. But I really do feel it was that close to being something that could have been embracing this as much as honestly, something like M. Night Shyamalan's Knock at the Cabin. I think the ending of both movies are very reminiscent in a way that I feel like isn't a coincidence. And I feel like that movie, it made its point in a way that I was like, yeah, you know what? Well, this is really, really well made. And I feel like the monkey didn't quite get there. It's obviously doing something very different in a very different way. But those two movies, that's the comparison I come up with that I've been going back to.
You know, Jimmy, you make a really good point there in terms of, you know, having to drill that theme down in the script and it didn't work for you that way. And I think, thinking about it as we're talking about the film right now, I think one of the reasons that I found an in was because I do have contentious relationship with my brother. He's only a couple years younger than me. We're not twins, thank goodness. So there's not that added surreality of, oh, this person looks like me and sounds like me, but we're not the same. Which I can't imagine what that existence must be like for actual identical twins. I have never met any in my life, so I don't know how they function as people, but it must be very strange to have that in your life from birth. But I just know that why I really did respond to, and it felt, I think you said Stand By Me earlier, Ben, too, in terms of like, yeah, that relationship between boys growing into men, and it's even harder when it's a blood relative. And Thank God, you know, my relationship with my brother is nowhere near as bad as it is in this film. But there is that sense that we are two very different people, despite the fact that we grew up under the same roof with the same parents, you know, same environment. And there are moments when he looks at me and I look at him and we're like, who are you? Like, where did you come from? Because we're from the same place and yet we are very different people. And, you know, I think things are in a good place with us right now. But for a couple years there, they weren't so much. And I could really relate to that. And I do feel like if the monkey has a grounding, because ultimately it is way over the top, very deliberately so, we know it's, you know, completely absurd. But if it has a grounding, it's an emotional one for me in terms of like, this is how it feels to live in a world where nothing makes sense. And I know that you were just saying like, okay, you know, throw up your hands, nothing matters. You have to give us something that will ground us. And so I think that's the way I found it into that.
Yeah, that's great. Well, thanks for sharing that, Bill. I think that's a good transition into the point at that the movie kind of lost me is the Bill character, like the introduction of this mullet wearing Theo James version of this character, where he didn't really make much sense to me. There's a conversation that he has with Hal at the end where he talks about not ever really thinking about the fact that the two of them shared a mother and that therefore they shared that loss when their mother is killed early in the film, which feels like something that doesn't require any kind of revelation to understand. Like, you're twins, of course, you have the same mother. I don't understand how that's something that needed any thought put into it whatsoever. And then, like, you know, there's like the nitpicky stuff that you could get into of like, he has this compound. What does he do for work? You know, he just seems to be like single-mindedly focused on revenge and like, what the hell has this guy been doing for all of these intervening years while this monkey was down at the bottom of a well? And there's just like a lot of stuff that kind of I'm willing to hand wave away because it's a movie and the movie is not really interested in that. So arguably I shouldn't be super interested in that either. But I think the Bill half of that twin duo is just so underbaked in a way that it kind of made me start thinking about these other things that I don't think Perkins wanted me to be thinking about. So I don't know if any of you have a response to that stuff or the characterizations between Hal and Bill or any of that.
I will say Bill, the way Bill's fate in this movie, it caught me completely off guard. It's one of those, again, it's one of those kills that kind of takes you by surprise. And it's pretty mean, it's pretty nasty, but I will say this one actually kind of worked for me because I kind of like the idea of, you know, life is messy in that sort of way, where even if you spent an entire lifetime making mistakes, not necessarily living up to your potential, or just being beset by trauma and not being able to overcome that, that felt really true to life for me. And you know, maybe other people feel that that was one of the kills that went too far, and I could totally understand that. But I was kind of on board with Perkins, you know, the way he underlined that point where he was like, yeah, this kind of, it's not always a happy ending. And you kind of have to like figure out a way to live with that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So before we get into Bill's interview with Oz Perkins, I just wanted to ask you guys to wrap up here. Did you have a favorite kill or maybe most ridiculous kill or however you want to define that from this movie? Bill, let's start with you.
I think everything involving Mr. Perkins himself as the uncle, from his sideburns to his revelation that they're swingers to his ultimate demise via it's horses, right? Or some animal that runs over him, and the reveal of the sleeping bag chili, which is insane as a visual to me. And then this movie may have my favorite hard cut in a movie of 2025, which is the young Hal and Bill talking about, well, maybe we should try the monkey's key again. We should do that. Before we even get to them turning it or touching it or even looking at the monkey, we cut right to his, you know, funeral picture, and it's just beautiful. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's great. What about you, Jeremy?
I'm going to go with one of the earliest kills, which is the babysitter at Hibachi. And this taps into a very unusual childhood fear of mine where my family, we love going out for, you know, like buffets, that sort of thing. And when I finally tried Hibachi for the first time and you just see this cook going wild in front of you with an open flame going and he's throwing food and spritzing drinks into your mouth And I'm just sitting there wondering, like, how does this not go horribly wrong all the time and end up on the nightly news every single day? So this tapped into that extremely specific curiosity of mine in a way that I've never seen in a movie before, which I very much appreciated.
I think my favorite is probably the woman diving into the pool and just exploding for some reason. I don't know about the physics of that moment, but it was incredibly entertaining. So shout out to that. And like up maybe like a partial leg making it all the way across the pool deck over to the Hal character. Yeah, just a very entertaining execution of that idea for sure. Okay, and also real quick while we're in the spoiler section, I just want to say shout out to Adam Scott, who I had no idea was in this movie, just starting things off in an interesting way. And then also shout out to Tatiana Maslany. I thought she did a great job, and she's not in the movie very much, but I kind of wish she was in it more because there's just something to her. I haven't seen her in something in a little while. I tapped out of She-Hulk after like one episode, so I'm not like super familiar with her sort of late period post Orphan Black work. And I was just very glad to see her. I thought she was a great presence in this movie. So
yeah, she's
her.
A great boy mom in this. And as you'll hear in my interview, she's going to be one of the few leads of Perkins's next one. So it's really promising to see them work together so well.
That's awesome.
That's, fantastic. Okay, cool. Let's take a quick break and then we'll come back and get into Bill's interview with Oz Perkins.
Yeah, sure thing. Hey, you sold that car yet?
Yeah, sold it to Carvana.
Oh, I thought you were selling to that guy.
The guy who wanted to pay me in foreign currency, no interest over 36 months? Yeah, no. Carvana gave me an offer in minutes, picked it up, and paid me on the spot. It was so convenient.
Just like that.
Yeah.
No hassle.
None.
That is super convenient.
Sell your car to Carvana and swap hassle for convenience. Pickup fees may apply.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are now boarding Group A. Please have your boarding passes ready to scan. If your phone is cracked, old, or was chewed up by your Chihuahua travel companion, please refrain from holding up the line. Instead, go to Verizon and trade in any phone in any condition from one of their top brands for the new Samsung Galaxy S25 Plus with Galaxy AI and a watch and tab on any plan. Only on Verizon.
With new line on my plan. Service plan required for watch and tab. Additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.
It's absolutely an honor to meet you. I am such a fan of your work. Congratulations on the film. Your movies up to this point have such a power over me when I watch them in terms of making me feel like I'm trapped in a nightmare I can't wake up from. And watching The Monkey and then describing it to friends of mine, I realized, oh, this sounds like I'm describing a weird dream that I had. So I wanted to ask you, do dreams inspire you at all in your work? Do you have a vested interest in trying to translate that experience to the screen, or is it just a byproduct of your work?
I think it's probably it's occurred to me in more interviews that I give how much what I do comes from an unconscious place. Like, I'm not usually what I'm generating is coming from stuff that I've absorbed and forgotten, right? Mm. Or absorbed and has sort of gone down into the sediment enough that now it's not conscious anymore. And stuff will come out, especially in the course of writing something like this movie, where once I kind of absorbed the short story, I never really looked at it again. And then was surprised after I wrote it and made the movie to look back at Stephen King's book on writing, and realize how much of that, which I had read years ago, I had used in the movie, the relationship with the babysitter, the stuff with the parents, like a lot of the stuff was taken from that. And I had totally forgotten about all of it. So I don't know that necessarily dreams, I'm not someone who wakes up and writes their dreams down and then uses those things. But I do think that the unconscious is working in my favor. I've managed to kind of connect to it in the process where I don't even really know that it's happening, which I guess makes sense because it's the unconscious.
Absolutely. On a similar note, in terms of approaching this the way that you did with such a great comedic angle was, I know that you've talked about, that you thought it was feeling the material and about, a movie about a toy, that sort of thing. But was it something conscious on your part, or is it more unconscious about switching up your style in this way?
I think it's really just a matter of doing the thing that is required, right? And so if you look at everything that you create as an assignment, either it's from a boss or it's from your spirit, or it's from some idea that you had, or it's from the muse or the source or whatever you want to call it. Like, you're being given this assignment to sort of honor this thing that exists whether you want it to or not, or exists in sort of whether you're going to do it or not. It's out there, and it's sort of my job to kind of find it and put it into its place, right? Or give it form, give it shape, and then give it away. And so with this, it was kind of just like the confluence of things. It's like, well, if the monk, it, I'm given the opportunity to do a Stephen King thing. Oh, it's the monkey. Oh, the toy monkey is just like this thing that everybody, whether they have a, they could verbalize it or not. There's a thing about looking at a monk, toy monkey like that, which is an uncanny thing where you're like, you're revulsed, but you're kind of, you think it's sort of cute and sort of funny and sort of playful, but it's awful. Like, there's this weird relationship with it. But I knew that everybody had a thing about it. So I knew the poster was going to be the monkey. It just had to be. What else is it going to be? It's like the fucking monkey. It's the title. It's the thing. And then you see the smile on it, and you're like, well, you could kind of go the obvious way with it and make it like an evil smile that it's like dark, or you could go for the leer and feel like there's sort of a cheekiness to it. There's like a surreal kind of cheekiness to this. And so it just sort of evolved that I didn't see myself trying to make a serious possessed toy movie. And also just the fact that it was going to be about kind of a meditation on death felt like a bummer. If you're going to do a downer about that, you might as well kind of give an uplift. It's a pretty tricky conversation topic for most people. So might as well pitch it as like with a smile.
And speaking of that smile, I mean, obviously the comedy horror hybrid movie has been around for ages and ages, and yet it's still something that seems to trip people up when they talk about it or when they're trying to define it. I know that some people think that it makes the comedy not as funny or it makes the horror not as scary. Now that you've made, a variety of horror films in your career, and then this one being so intentionally funny, what's your view on comedy horror? Do you think it's a viable hybrid?
I think you're right to say that it's a tough one, but kind of everything is a tough one, right? There's no center of the bullseye where everyone's like, well, if I just write a romantic comedy, it'll be great. Like, horror comedy is just maybe just as hard as anything else. Maybe the problem sometimes with horror comedy is that the comedy ends up being dumb, right? And I think what we ended up with here is comedy that's at least intelligent enough. And because my comic sensibility grows out of things like The Simpsons, right, where it's like the smartest fucking comic writers on the block, or any Brad Bird thing, like the Incredibles is funny to me, Ratatouille is really funny to me, like that kind of deadpan intelligent humor we were able to get, as opposed to something sort of sophomoric and kind of cheap, which I think sometimes gets resorted to in the horror comedy space. But I never even I kind of abandoned the horror element of it. Like, I guess I don't really think of this movie as a horror movie. I know that it's going to be classified as one, but to me, it's just too absurd for that, and gives too much of a good feeling ultimately to be just a straight horror movie.
Absolutely. Well, speaking of the absurdism of the movie, those kills are some of the best I've seen in a long while in terms of just insanity. Did you ever go too far? Was there something that got out of your control that you had to abandon or cut in terms of kill sequences or?
Only the occasional thing that was just like practically we couldn't kind of wrap our heads around it. And but by the time we got to the shooting script, everything that was in the shooting script we accomplished. I mean, there was nothing that kind of got the better of us, and we ended up adding some stuff even because we felt kind of good about ourselves and like we had a good rhythm going. So some things were actually put in later, when we wanted to kind of goose the levels that we all had. But no, nothing was beyond us. When you're making a movie with people who are capable and fun and creative and young and spirited and willing to have a good time, you can really kind of do anything.
Another thing, I've seen this movie, I've been lucky enough to see it twice now, and each time with an audience, it's great when the Annie Wilkes name drop happens. You have that tittering throughout the audience of like, what? Who's that? No. Were there other King references that you threaded through that
There
people
were
found yet, or?
a couple that didn't make it into the cut. There's the whatever, I can't remember exactly what the graffiti in the prison cell is in Shawshank Redemption. Someone was here. I can't remember the wording, but we had that on a set. We didn't use the shot that had it in it. The only other one that comes to my mind is the name of the teacher in the sex ed class is Mrs. Torrance.
Oh, beautiful. Another element that I really like that's really fun and to watch when you're watching it for the first time, or anytime, is I don't know how to describe it exactly, but it's like these little analog, almost VHS cutaway flashbacks for when Ricky is having flashes of his father. And of course, there's all those aspect ratio changes during Long Legs. When you're making stylistic choices like that, is it more? I know this is kind of coming back to the same question I asked you already, but are those from a script level, or is that something you're finding during production or even post-production?
Long Legs was on a script level. In terms of it, when it came to the monkey was all sort of one format, and then we decided to add in that memory of his dad. And it just felt, when you're making a movie and you have the sort of you're being given the trust to kind of do your thing, you want to do your thing, right? And so you want to do what you like. And so if you see something that you like, kind of go get it and use it and do it. And that was what was it was in Long Legs. Like Andres, the DP, and I, we wanted to shoot some VHS, so we shot some VHS. And then in terms of this, like I just wanted to kind of enrich the texture a little bit. And yeah, it's just you do what feels right. It's sort of a weak thing to say, but it makes sense to me.
I think one of the coolest aspects of the movie that's maybe unsung because there's so much going on in it, and the kills take center stage and all that, but the way that you're pretty seamlessly integrating Theo and Christian as twin characters and that sort of thing. How production-wise, how complicated was it? Was it sort of a smooth process for y'all, or was it, oh gosh, we have to remember this person's here and the continuity and all that sort of thing?
When it came to Christian, we did think he was together. They were together in a lot of scenes, right? Bill and Hal end up being together only once, so we did that last. We did adult Bill and Hal ended up being together only in the finale scene, which we did very last. So that by that time we were kind of good at everything, and we sort of knew how to do the thing, and we knew how to lock off the shot in a certain way, and we knew how to get the plates correct, and we knew how to get the thing lined up with the thing, get the handshake, and all that. But when it came to doing it with Christian playing them as kids, you do it the hard way. You got Christian dressed as one kid, and you have his double dressed as another kid, and you shoot that side, you lock it off, you wait, he changes, you come back, you shoot the other side, you do that, you change him, you switch him back, you wait, you shoot the other side. And all the time you're looking at your watch, you're like, well, that's taken a long time, but it works.
No, it works brilliantly. Just to wrap up, I am so looking forward to Keeper coming, I think later this year, because
October.
I don't know what to expect from you next now. Is there anything hint-wise you might be able to drop in terms of where you're going?
I would say that Keeper is sort of the intimate one, right? Keeper is sort of a, it's more or less a two-hander. It's more or less Tatiana Maslany and Ross of Sutherland in a relationship. And it takes place more or less entirely in a house on a property. So it has that sort of in a house horror trope leading it, but you can probably guess it's not exactly like one that you've seen. I suppose it's sort of more subtle, I guess, than the previous two pictures. Like you couldn't get a lot less subtle than long legs, right? Like, I mean, long legs is about as unsubtle as anything could possibly be, and the monkey's kind of just that squared. So maybe for Keeper, you can think of it things as being dialed back to be just a little bit more sort of insidious. How about that? Not like the movie Insidious, but the descriptor Insidious.
A word. It's a word first.
It's a word. It's still an adjective.
James Wan, you don't own the English language yet. Well, thank you so much for talking to me today, Mr. Perkins. It's such a joy to watch your movies, and I'm so excited to see everything you got coming down the line.
My pleasure, man. Thanks very much, Bill.
All right, guys, before we wrap up, any closing thoughts? I know we're running a little long here, but just anything, I just wanted to give you guys an opportunity to wrap up your case or just say anything you either liked or didn't like about the movie that we didn't have a chance to talk about earlier. Jeremy, how about you?
I will say shout out to Elijah Wood for understanding the assignment and chewing up the scenery in exactly one scene that he appears in this movie. I knew he was going to be in this movie. I knew to expect Elijah Wood going all out because he just loves, you know, he's obviously such a big presence in the indie film scene and like going to film festivals and stuff. And just so this movie seemed entirely up his alley. And I was waiting the entire time for him to finally pop up. And he lived up to expectations. He was fantastic. And I want to see him doing this kind of thing much more often.
Yeah. 100%. Yeah. For people who are interested in Elijah Wood's work and kind of like to see him in this sort of like weird little guy mode, there's a movie called I Don't Want to Live in This World Anymore that played
oh,
at
yes.
Sundance.
Love that movie.
Yeah. This was from like 2015 or something, and Netflix acquired it at a Sundance and just kind of dumped it on the streaming service. And I feel like that movie does not really have a big cultural footprint because it just kind of disappeared into the Netflix ether. But if anybody's looking for a great Melanie Lynskey and Elijah Wood team up film, that one I think is still sitting there on Netflix for you. So I don't want to live in this world anymore is what it's called. All right, Bill, last word goes to you. What do you think?
All right. I would just like to take this opportunity to get something off my chest and reveal that, yes, as you may have suspected, I am in the pocket of Big Monkey.
I knew
all
it.
Monkey films I am a full supporter of. So Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, yes. Better Man, yes. The Monkey, absolutely yes. So if you see a monkey in a movie, chances are I'm going to talk about it and chill for it.
Amazing. All right. What a way to end. Thank you both for joining me today. And I think that's going to do it for today's show. You can find more about The Monkey, including Jeremy's review of the film at slashfilm.com. I will link to that review in the show notes of this very episode. Slash Film Daily is typically published every weekday, bringing the most exciting news from the world of movies and TV, as well as deeper dives into the great features you can find on the site. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That really helps us out a lot. Tell your friends about the show any way you can. Thanks so much for listening, and we will talk to you all next week.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are now boarding Group A. Please have your boarding passes ready to scan. If your phone is cracked, old, or was chewed up by your Chihuahua travel companion, please refrain from holding up the line. Instead, go to Verizon and trade in any phone in any condition from one of their top brands for the new Samsung Galaxy S25 Plus with Galaxy AI and a watch and tab on any plan. Only on Verizon.
With new line on my plan. Service plan required for watch and tab. Additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.
At Planet Fitness, we're declaring it. This is the year of getting stronger. And future stronger you can get started now by saving $28 or more when you join today. You in? We have all the best-in-class equipment you could ever need to keep stepping it up. And free fitness training to help you mix up your routine. Plus, most clubs are open 24 hours. So let's do this. Join Planet Fitness today and save $28 or more. Just $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends February 28th. See Home Club for details.